Okay, welcome to this episode of The Outrun Show. We are talking today about some touchy topics. World Chase Tag will come up today. We have what it's like to train hard. You know, last week we talked about training and recovery, sort of the more relaxed side of training. We're going to talk about suffering, maybe a little bit about pain today.
A little bit about pain.
And keeping with that theme, we're talking about why sometimes it's more dangerous to build parkour obstacles than it is to actually train on them. All that.
Blood sacrifice.
And sacrifice. All that blood sacrifice and more on The Outrun Show.
All right.
So starting off, Justin, I think, just give us a quick what happened with the hand. You don't have to go into the gritty details of
this. This would have been fine if I had just built it with like archaic tools. All right. It's stone.
What do you mean, like a chisel?
Electricity and power. It's too much for me to handle.
The theme is pain, and the theme is speed. And so explain how speed hurts you, Justin. We want to stay authentic and transparent on the show. So when stuff goes wrong, we just can't be like, oh, I was skateboarding and fell off. So
do you need the full explanation?
Just give him the quick rundown.
I mean, it's just a spinning wrench just came and got revenge on me.
Whack, whack, whack.
Yeah. So Justin broke.
It's very hard to describe.
This metacarpal right here, right?
Pinky metacarpal on the left hand.
He's got a spinning Allen wrench.
Yep.
Which was tightening another power tool. So
you turn on the power tool and the Allen wrench, which is shaped at a 90-degree angle, was
spinning around
and wrapped his knuckles basically thrice.
Maybe just once.
I don't know, it seemed like forever. It took a trip or two around the world and broke his hand and his
did a hard stop on Justin's hand.
I don't know if it stopped. I think it just kept going.
I think if we're being honest, like we've all suffered more like injuries, if you will, from was especially Justin. Justin's been our sacrificial lamb on pretty much every construction job.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Crash test.
But yeah, we have a joke that every new location we move to, we have to give like a blood sacrifice during the construction. Either somebody you know is doing something and they scrape their hand or something.
It needs to drop onto the ground.
Yeah, and soak into the soil.
If you can't put a band-aid on it right away, you have to let it, you know, be absorbed.
Right.
And unfortunately, like a payment to Mother Gaia. And unfortunately, Justin happens to be that guy most times. Yes.
Pagan parkour.
Yes. It's pretty hilarious because Olaf moved up. Foam pit out I think a couple weeks ago, and I asked him, I said, Olaf, did you do the move out ceremony, because you're the first person to start the move out? And he says, oh no, I didn't do that. And I was like, no, you're in trouble now, Olaf. And then here we go, the week later he calls it out too. He's like, Justin, you gonna do your little fancy move out ceremony? I'm like, nah dude, you already ruined it.
Oh,
an hour later.
It was a double denial. You can deny it one time, but if you deny it twice.
The gym gods were like, we see that disrespect, Justin.
Now you will sacrifice. Also, I would say that, weren't we talking about foam pits being the place of common injury in a couple episodes ago? And technically, the bars were attached to the foam pit.
Yeah.
It's true. It was a foam pit project. Sure. So. Well, now you can't. You have like what, 3 fingers at work, right? You can't use it.
Yeah, it's coming back. It's not too bad. Just a little hairline fracture there, so I can move everything. I just can't like put pressure or weight on that pinky. Definitely no handstands.
So no pinky handstands.
Yeah.
Cool. Well you also won't be then tagging anybody, right?
Ooh. Now you have to play. You have to play World Chase Tag with one arm.
Yeah. Tuck this guy up. This you'll run like little kids do when little kids run, and like,
right? Exactly.
Still figuring out that contralateral movement.
Exactly. You did get the handstand in though, luckily, on the heavy machinery over at the groundbreaking. So
yeah,
we snuck that one in right before.
Yeah, this would be embarrassing to have with that.
Yeah, for the groundbreak.
I just wouldn't wear it.
Really? It was like, hey, why is that guy's hand kind of hanging off at the wrist? A little floppy. Awesome. So Speaking of hands, World Chase Tag. So if you guys don't know what World Chase Tag is, it is basically the sport of tag on obstacles in a, I think it's 40 by 40 arena. Mm-hmm. It started in the UK by parkour people. It was actually the, I think the dads or a dad of a young parkour athlete out of the UK. Kind of started that stuff in their backyard and built it up. So it is a parkour bootstrap project. Therefore, we support it and its spirit. It's just one element of parkour, but obviously parkour people make the most sense for chase tag.
Absolutely. I mean,
right? So it's kind of a little sport or subgenre of parkour that's definitely made for us. And I think it's going to blow up. I think it's super popular. I think we've seen Ultimate Tag. That's the reality TV version one, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about that before. There are parkour athletes on that as well. And they have the fastest times. And then you sort of have this American Gladiator theme thing going on with the ultimate tag. And
it's a bit more like game show entertainment added to it rather than a traditional sport.
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of fun. It's its own thing, but that ultimate tag scenario is not really a sport. You still have producers doing things. That being said, top times on that show are definitely parkour athletes. World Chase Tag should be recognized really as the sport. It was there before. It's been around for a while. And they just, I think it was NBC Sports, just got the agreed on the rights for the licensing of World Chase Tag. So that's really big news because it's essentially a parkour sport that is...
That's still, I think what matters too is that it's still a parkour sport, right?
It's so still a parkour sport.
The people that are on the, you know, the team of executives for World Chase Tag are parkour people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what matters, is because parkour appeals to a lot of people, but, you know, and even though we excel at various different shows, like, you know, your Floor is Lava, Ninja Warrior, all these other ones, it's always parkour people on the show, but now parkour people running the show. Right?
And the other thing that happens is that I don't really have too much of a problem with this, but I think it's a bit disingenuous and proves that that's TV stuff, is that you'll have someone who comes on the show and just has no background. They're just pulling people in for like the story. When we look at like the TV show stuff, Ninja Warrior, Ultimate Tag, where you've got people who are like, well, here is this, you know, like Brandon Douglas was on Beastmaster, and he, for all, you know, recognized and intentional purposes for being that type of obstacle course athlete, parkour athlete, speed athlete, and an excellent skill athlete, is up there. And then you have, like, you know, here's Bob from CrossFit Globo Gym, right? Tossed in, and then everybody's like sort of presented as equal at that point. We're like, wait, no, this is like a pro athlete. It's as if we said, like, all right, we're doing, you know, half court basketball. We're calling it a different sport. And then we bring an NBA athlete in and we just have like Bob from Bob's CrossFit comes in. And you're like, wait, that's okay, whatever. So this is, you know, the athletes are vetted. There's a way to participate. And most of the athletes, all the athletes we know, like, I don't think there's been somebody on there that maybe they're just not super active on social media or whatnot. But when you look at World Chase Tag, you can see all your friends in the parkour community. And I think that's awesome. And in order to get on there and do well, you have to go up against them. And that's the other thing these TV shows don't have, which is the producers are selecting who goes on there.
Yeah, there's no casting call, right? Like, they come in and they're like, oh, sorry, we're not looking for tall white guys right now. Mm-hmm. So, like, they're out, you know?
Yep.
They're looking for athletes who are good at it regardless of everything else, right?
Yeah.
So you come in and I'm not entirely certain on the process of getting to the show, but it involves actually playing, right? They're essentially qualifiers that you have to qualify for, and so I think that's again another point towards it's a genuine thing as opposed to, you know, like, we've all done some casting calls for like Ninja Warrior, Beastmaster, or those ones, right? And it's like some dude's just like, no, sorry, we're not looking for your type of person, or your backstory doesn't have enough cancer in it.
Right. So. And I had plenty of cancer for my backstory.
You did, and they still didn't pick you.
They did use my footage, though. I was on the season 7 open for the show, and then not actually on the show, which in hindsight, I'm happier about because it's less work and all the glory, I suppose.
Well, they didn't. There wasn't any shout out to you, but you do get to see yourself.
Yeah, I didn't even know. Some kids like messaged me and like, "Hey, you're on the show," and I'm like, "No, I'm not." They didn't call me back. And I'm like, "No, you're on the show," and I watch. Oh,
there's me.
Yeah, there's me. Cool. In that discussion, so I'm on USPK, which is the governing organization of parkour in the United States. I'm on one of the committees for a competition, and we had the early discussion of would. World Chase Tag be something that we would endorse, and we decided that was the case because we really felt like this was elevating the athletes within parkour, and as long as the athletes who participated, who were part of the community and doing authentic parkour, supported the sport, that we would support them and the sport in conjunction there. So it's really a great opportunity for this sort of like subgenre of parkour. I know it's a lot different than how people typically train parkour, and we have not trained that much tag, but
in fact, we discourage tag in the gym.
Yeah, ironically, most parkour gyms say you can't, and that's for safety reasons, though. You know, I mean, even in open gyms and whatnot, because that's even more respect to these athletes, because you can't go out there without accepting some risk. It is probably the closest thing to fighting that parkour has. In the sense that the risk of running in at speed and close quarters with rails, like I mean, you can watch the clips. I've seen dudes, you know, get their hands stomped on trying to pivot and be underneath another guy.
Like grabbing a bar or something.
Playing tag requires a very good handle of your situational awareness, but also your talents and adrenaline and just...
Vision.
Social pressure. There's so many elements when you're playing a game like that that parkour is just a little too much to handle during those times. So it's very impressive that a professional athlete can handle a camera on them, and then the room's black, and you have black bars, and you have black flooring, and they can avoid hitting their heads on stuff. But
I think they have silver bars. And then the floor is like a gray,
Oh, it's white. Maybe the floor is white.
The floor is white to contrast the bars from top.
Are the bars black?
Yeah.
I think the bars are black.
Yeah.
I feel like that's silver.
I can't decide if that's good or bad. But for kids, it's just, I think you can play this. You can play tag yourself and figure out how long you can play it before one of you gets hurt. And then you can understand why parkour gyms don't allow tag.
Well, and kids can play tag because they run at like 5 miles an hour. So when they run into stuff, it hurts, but it doesn't break. But these athletes are moving at 12 to 15 miles an hour. They're in full sprints, right? And when a grown man runs into a bar and hits his head, that's catastrophic, right? And so the level of skill that these athletes have to meet to be able to compete at that high level is tremendous. Not just physically, but also mentally, and being able to keep like, oh, well, you know, I'm being chased or I'm chasing. He's behind me to my left here. I'm going to duck under this bar, right? So they have to keep in mind all of this and that person and the lights and the camera. And it's pretty quiet when they're going, which is awesome. I love that. Rather than like loud music playing and all that stuff, which is cool. Why we don't allow it in the gym, just because.
It's too easy to take a risk to justify escaping your opponent.
Yep.
And so one thing that World Chase Tag does too is it keeps its heights very low, and it's very condensed, controlled environment. And I don't necessarily think parkour gyms were designed with that application in mind.
No,
we're designed
very
with unlimited possibilities, right? And when you have unlimited possibilities and you have tag, it's not a very good overlap. You need a very controlled area with obstacles that you know very well that you can play tag on and that you can predict really well. So,
yeah, and so that people understand also what the shapes are going to be when they go into the competition, which is something that we talked about in USPK's competition standards was, you know, if someone comes into a competition, they should be familiar, maybe not with the entire setup, which I think a World Chase Tag leans more towards, but they should know what they're getting into, right? So if I come into a comp and I'm thinking, okay, World Chase Tag, this is going to be pretty cool. And I come out and there's like, you know, a clown that, that bounces out of a box and could attack me. Like, that's not cool, because like there should be, within reason, I should know what I'm going to be encountering on mm-hmm. the course and not risk my sacrifice my body to survive. Yeah, this chase tag is not pillow fight parkour.
Not pillow fight parkour.
It's not soft. It's not like you run and giggle and fall in the grass and you're like, it's so joyful. Like, this is an intense stuff. It's fun and fun to watch too. That's why I think it's going to blow up. It's very easy to understand.
Yeah.
And it's easy to get what when someone won. I mean, they just make the screen turn red or green in the vision. And
its simplicity is certainly what appeals to it, right? Yeah. You don't have to learn the rules. It's just 20 seconds. Can you not get tagged? Right? It's 20 seconds, right? It's 20 seconds on, 20 seconds off.
Yeah, you have the... Yeah.
Or I guess they're both on, but one you're chasing, right. One you're getting chased. Right. Right?
Correct.
And it's like, it's just... Can you survive or can you catch? It's very simple. Just like,
and it's a very, it's very much part of the nature of parkour. I think anyone who's trained parkour for some time has wondered, like, can someone get me? Can they not? And played chase tag. And so it's sort of one of those fundamental, like, games. Sebastian Foucan has been on the show. We've talked about him before. He is one of the founders of parkour. And then he came to Boulder, a couple years ago, and we played tag as part of his little workshop or whatnot. So it's definitely been there forever. It's kind of what I'm saying. That's why I'm bringing him up in this. And he's actually competed at 45 in the actual events. So it's cool to see people who are older. Although I would say, just don't like. I'm just going to say it right now. If you are an older person, I'm going to say older than, 18 or something like that, and you think you have been sedentary or you think you're a pretty good athlete and you're going to get out and you're going to try parkour in the context of chase tag, get ready to be injured. Because this is very, I wonder, and you guys tell me what you think. One of the things I love about World Chase Tag right now is that a lot of the athletes are competing as sort of a category of parkour, meaning that, like, if you look at like Seth Ruggie, he's doing the speed comps, he's doing style comps, he's also doing the chase stuff. Like, it's mm-hmm. parkour athlete. The store guys are in World Chase Tag, but they're still doing their videos and their competitions elsewhere. It's very cool that people can still do like sort of the full body of parkour and also be successful and at the highest level in this. I wonder if it will over specialize and turn into guys who just do chase tag, or if you will have to sort of still do the major facets of parkour to remain competitive, right? Because even if you just jumped in and you're like, I'm going to do it, and you're an athlete and you get really special with those skills, the context of training outside and training at a high level, maybe even in gyms, is an advantage. That's why people can come in and do so well on these.
I think it'll depend on the obstacles. If it's the same obstacles that never change, so you have that tilted cube and the mountain.
What do the obstacles look like right now for people who will link out the show? But what are they describing?
It's very low platforms that aren't very big at all, and then they have lots of bars that are strung together between these obstacles, and a few ramps where you have longer plank-like obstacles.
But there's no sound.
It's symmetrical, right? Like, the corners are
mirrored, there's a little bit of variance in there. Like, there's some one corner that has a different obstacle than the rest of the corners. Okay. So, but if the obstacles stay the same, then there absolutely will be some specialization for those obstacles. You can already see it. Like, there are some corners where they're whipping around using the bar as leverage, or they're dive rolling through, or they're sliding. And sliding isn't really a big parkour thing. So, you already see one specialized movement coming out of it, which is sliding on a floor, which you just don't get in outside. You're dealing with concrete. So
it's not.
I can already see just a little bit of specialization coming, and as long as maybe the obstacles change or the platforms get bigger, then I think that the outside trainer parkour athletes will have a little bit of advantage. But if it stays the same, you'll have to specialize.
Yeah, I think sliding is a good thing to call out. I've seen sliding like at NAPC. I've seen sliding in parkour comps, but usually because most parkour gyms have stable mats on the ground or grass on the outside, in some cases concrete, it's not as common, but it, the entire floor is slick, so I could totally see that being something that has to, your sliding skills have to be there to get better and better at it.
Well, and there's like diving through or vaulting through windows, right? Which is a parkour thing, but often we're working with larger shapes and larger areas outside. You're not often like diving through these small gaps at speed, you know? There are a few like notable athletes that are really good at that, you know, or who just like that's something they're in. Like Tom Coppola is really good at doing these like dive rolls through like things that are the size of my eye. Right? And I'm like, what? So he's really good at that kind of stuff. But now they have to take it to a different level because it's not just that singular skill. They have to go through there and keep moving, right? And in fact, just the other day, Olaf and I were setting up things in the gym just before classes had started. And we're trying to practice these like vaults through these tiny windows, you know, and I'm not a big guy and it's hard, right? Like it's difficult to do these vaults at speed through these windows, which I think is also cool because historically parkour comps have always catered towards like taller, lankier people, right?
Yes.
But if you're tall and long, it's very hard to vault through a small 2.5 by 2.5 mm-hmm. window, you know? So
and
it does.
Tom's a little shorter, right? He's not.
I think Tom's like a couple inches taller than me.
Okay.
So I think he's like 5'9".
5'9" or something like that? Yeah.
I don't know.
And ironically, or not ironically, but appropriately, he was on Ultimate Tag as well and has the fastest time on that
show.
Oh,
yeah. He's an awesome athlete. So I think that's another kind of, I would say it's specialized, right? It's because it's a very specific thing that you don't encounter outside very often unless you're looking for it.
Yeah, usually when you're outside, it's not a speed thing. It's like a challenge. So you have time to prepare and you don't necessarily have something right after it that you need to, again, have speed out of. So speed in, speed out, and tag someone. That's a very specialized thing for World Chase Tag.
I think that I've not... I think that one of the things that parkour athletes typically are missing is the understanding, and this is why another reason why I think that at least as a subgenre of parkour, chase tag is awesome, is because we're not used to having a, like, it's not necessarily combatives, but sort of that dimension of sparring. Like sparring doesn't exist, and now you have to track another human and or run or pursue or whatever, and you're looking for openings and you're looking to like juke people and for your weight distribution to like send them off in a particular way. That's a skill which I had not necessarily a tag context, but being able to read another human being's body movement, I picked up from martial arts, from competitive martial arts. And you would start to look at the shoulder and look at the hips and see if you could see what direction someone's going to commit to and then read that. So I think that's something that is going to fill out as a cool skill in parkour, even if that was done at a lower level, right? You don't need a zillion bars, but even if you're just looking at working on reading which direction someone's going to go, that could be fun as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that sort of head-to-head nature, which is something parkour doesn't have a lot of, right? Yeah. Even in our competitions, it's not head-to-head.
Right, it's not pursuit in general.
It's very much
individual. Yeah.
Individual and then comparing, right, rather than going head-to-head in this sort of... So I'm excited to kind of see where it goes and what happens to it.
And this season kicks off in, I think it's next month, right?
In Atlanta.
Hotlanta. Mm-hmm. And Olaf's going to go down and compete with some of the Colorado guys. And I think there's a couple teams coming out of Colorado. And just so fun. Because I've had people message me and they're like, hey, have you ever seen this? And they'll send me the message like, yeah. Like, I know those guys. This is really good. Like people who I would never have thought would be interested in parkour. And it's so nice to have that instead of should be on Ninja Warrior or did you see this episode of The Office?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's that's the gut check on whether this is a fit or not. Is whether I'm like, oh yeah, this is cool. And I know, you know, that versus.
Yeah. Submitted a video for it. Went on it. Yeah. Fell in the water.
Yeah, fell in the water. Yeah, you fell in the water. Yeah, so
we're excited. We'll I don't know if there's any specific info where you can watch the Atlanta qualifiers or not. But,
I don't know.
We will track that down and link it out.
Yeah, I would say just follow
our
channel.
We'll be, if there is, we'll be tuning in. I think it's October 18th.
Mid October. Olaf said he was gone then, so whenever we had to figure out staffing.
So we'll
when Olaf leaves, start looking for that.
we'll link it out, and then of course we'll be tuning in and cheering on our coach as he goes there, and our other Colorado athletes and our friends from abroad as they compete, and should be a good time.
Yeah, no losing on that. Everybody's cool.
But while we're talking about that, we know that right now is prime time for those athletes. Actually, 2 weeks before the comp, you're usually not training hard, but we know that for athletes that have wanted to go on this, speaking specifically for Olaf, I know that he's been training specifically for this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a perfect segue into what we wanted to talk about today, which is, you know, what is actual training? Because we've all heard people be like, oh yeah, I'm going to go train today. And they go out and they like sit on a rock and then they do a flip and then they go get coffee. Right.
Right.
And that's not training actually hard. Training hard. I wouldn't even say that's training. That's really just play. And that's cool, mm-hmm. too. Yeah. Play can be beneficial for training, but I wouldn't call that training.
So we but had...
Let's go. Yeah, just to keep it simple, what is training hard as a parkour athlete?
You need purpose.
I would say that's the defining difference between play and training.
There has to be an intent and a purpose and a goal and a plan of action if you're training, right? Like, you can't just... I don't know. I don't want to like gatekeep training, right? Too. So, I feel like if parkour athletes want to call going outside and playing and filming training too, that
well,
there is a different
is
level of it. Yeah, there is a different level of training for a competition. So I would say starting off with purpose, but that's my like least proficient aspect of parkour training. I almost tend to stray away from training for a competition. So,
you're right. Yeah. I was just going to say, I think purpose is a really, really big one. And I don't know. I'm definitely more of the line that, like, if you're like, well, my purpose is to come out and film a cool line, I still wouldn't consider that training. I'm sorry. Like,
yeah, I don't really call it that.
And I like that you said, I don't want to be like the gatekeeper of training. Like, if you're out there and you're moving and you're having a good time and you're progressing, awesome.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that you need to like change your verbiage or you need to like, oh, well, Jesse Clark from Mountain Run says that that's not training. So it's not, I don't need evangelists. I don't need anybody to like, you know, say that, like put some hard lines on there. I'm just saying that ultimately when you look at training for a traditional sport, most of those athletes are like, I hate training. I love game days, right? They love going onto the field and actually playing the game. But they don't enjoy showing up 6 a.m. on the field to run laps and drills, right? Typically, that's actually the worst part because their specific intent is game day, right? And so mm-hmm. that's training. If you're just going out onto the field, just to use the ball sports analogy again, if you're going out on the field to like play a pickup game of football or basketball or soccer with your friends, none of those athletes would call that training. They would say, yeah, we're just playing a game. And, you know, it's still good for us when it comes to competitive day because, you know, we're still practicing, which maybe might be a better term, practicing instead of training. But training has such a specific intent to it that I think if you're not like, I'm specifically coming out here to work on my strides, then it's not training. You're just practicing or playing. And that's cool, too. In fact, it's what I spend 90% of my time doing.
Yeah, well, if you are attempting what you're training for, then your training is attempting.
Yeah, so, it's game day.
Right? Yeah.
You're at game day, right?
If you're like, I really want a cork, or if I really want, you know, this big jump, and all you're doing is throwing corks and throwing big jumps, then you're attempting it. You're right, the game day. So I feel like training for parkour would be a little more fundamental than it looks like on YouTube for if we were comparing it to traditional sports.
Yeah. I do love, though, that we use the terminology of training as kind of the catch-all. I do think it lends some legitimacy to the sport, right? Because most of the
legitimacy, yeah, for sure.
Because even if a stranger came up to me when I was out training, and they were like, "What are you doing? Do you do parkour?" Yeah, I would say, just to keep it simple, yeah, I'm out here, I'm training parkour, right? I wouldn't say, whereas like a group of skaters wouldn't say, "I'm out here training skateboarding." They'd be like, "Yeah, I'm out here skating," right? Yeah. And so I do think it lends some legitimacy to the sport of parkour when people respond, "I'm training parkour," right? Parkour is the noun, not really the verb. Mm-hmm. and they're training it because people are like, oh, training. Athletes train. And you're like, yes, we are athletes.
Parkour really could use a verb. But parkouring...
Just parkouring, that's a bad verb. Don't use it.
So bad.
It's we use it in jest.
Yeah. Yeah, could use... Yeah, you're right. Parkouring could use a verb.
What do you think, though, Travis, about... Because you've been side-eyeing me here this whole time.
I was just waiting to see, like, what kind of hole you'd dig yourself with training definitions to see how riled up we could get listeners. I don't know. I mean... I think that what was key about last episode, I'm not in disagreement with your definitions. I think that there are some people who will say, yeah, training is when I just go out and I'm sort of laissez-faire, doing some softcore parkour on bushes or something. I don't know. And then like a dive roll to berry snatch, right? I don't know. Man, then you eat while you train, and they're like, "This is awesome," and I'd be like, "That's enlightened AF, right?" But and the
serene.
It's serene, right? I'd like admire that. And then there's other people who I look at and I say, "Oh man, I watch them do like a world tour and compete like a massive skill challenge with dysentery or something like that, right?" And I'd be like, "Dang, that's training. That's commitment.
Mid-air
dysentery. Like they have to wear an adult diaper just to stick prees because they're worried that they're gonna like have a blowout or something. I don't know. Like I can imagine a scenario like that happening and being like, no, that's dead. When I guess what I wanted to highlight in this episode is that last time we talked about some pretty soft stuff. I mean, we were like, no, we're gonna train and we're gonna sip a brevet and we're gonna recover and play video games for 5 days or 2 weeks or whatever you said that one time. And I just don't want I just want people to know we go hard on Earth. Like there is that, but there's also the reason I would need 2 weeks off is because I just annihilated myself and survived it and sort of danced the dance of recovery in relationship to that. And I think that's really, I think that's badass. If you can go and you can train and do things where people look at you and they're like, dude, if I did that, I would just destroy myself. But somehow you evaded injury. I have a lot of respect for that training. And then we kind of poke at the joke of grit fitness. But, in Chinese, they say eat bitter, right? Mm-hmm. And I just feel like, a lot of parkour athletes, a lot of people I've trained with in the past and myself can eat some serious bitter for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And I just want to call out that I think that's important. You don't have to do it, but we know how to train hard. And even though that's not kind of the staple of, because I don't think there's a lot of longevity in training at that level. But I just want to call out some of the times where we've trained the hardest. Since we talked about recovering the hardest last time, we're like, how hard do you recover? 2 weeks, video games, and chicken nuggets, right? Well, what's on the other side of that? Like, what's the hardest you've trained? What does training hard look like for you? Like, what's some grit that you've been through and what value did it bring?
Other than, like, the early days of parkour where it was, like,
that's fine.
You go on these trips and...
And whatever made you not soft?
I honestly, like, I look back on those days as, like, they're funny, but I don't look on them fondly.
Yes.
I guess I look on them fondly.
Like,
and
I would
that,
never
like,
do it again.
And like,
enjoy
but
it.
But I wouldn't. And if I could go back and tell myself, I wouldn't tell myself to do that stuff again either. Just because I know that training can be more effective.
Mm-hmm. There's a more intelligent way to train.
Yep. Exactly.
Exactly. And so, okay.
But I remember, I mean, we used to go down
but what is
every
that
weekend to Boulder. Our parents would drop us off at like 10, 11 o'clock. And we'd be there till 10, 11 o'clock at night, and we teach a couple of hours, with Ryan and Amos. We teach a couple hours first, and then we'd all go get lunch, and then we go and we train for like 6 hours at a particular spot. And that was like, those were like the golden days, right? And those were great, but they were one day a week where they were really intense, right? You get home and the next morning is always Sunday morning. You're like, oh, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sore, right? And then grandma would be like, start vacuuming. And I'd be like, no. But like
she's like banging the vacuum against our door.
Don't wake up.
She's like, oh, sorry. Don't.
And it's what did that? What did that work look like?
Well, most of the time we went out, and I use the term training. I'm guilty of my own thing. But it was a lot of it was play. We'd go out there and we'd design some sort of game or something. Or people had specific challenges that they wanted to work on. That people would break out and work on those things. But it was what was so intense about it is that it's all day long, right? It's not this like we go out for a couple hours and we train and then we go grab dinner and everybody gets home. It's 10 hours of parkour. There's no nap time in between, right? Like you grab lunch, you're sitting there, we go to Chipotle because we were all broke college kids. We were broke high school kids. But and then, you know, you get a giant burrito, you eat it, and then you go to the spot, you finish your burrito, you kind of let it digest a bit. And then you're back up to doing parkour again for the entire time. And just the length of time can just wear you down. But I think it is important that athletes learn some sort of like longevity around like training for that day. Not every session that you go out for needs to be 2 hours of straight bangers and then you're fried, right? Sometimes there is some wisdom in being able to train with your friends for 5+ hours of constant jumping and moving. And as power athletes, sometimes we can forget that, right? Sometimes we go out there, we hit a big jump, and then we're like, cool, going home. So I think that was definitely a lesson that I learned, is that sometimes you just got to be able to grind for a long time. It helped that it was still a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think parkour teaches a lot of perseverance, or teaches or forces upon you perseverance. And I think that's really good for parkour. I mean, these athletes will try the same thing a million times, and they will not be satisfied until they get it. And then when they get it, they have to do another variation of it. So that type of training, I think, is the traditional parkour that everyone does and calls it training, where you go out and you find a challenge and you just work on it until you get it. And that type of grit, who was very proficient, just a lot of it when we were growing up.
And prevalent.
Yeah. There you go. That's the P word I'm looking for. So so that was a lot of, that's like when I first learned Kong Gainer, it was outside. It was, or when I first did Kong Gainer, it was outside. I did it with those fall mats from bouldering mat. Yeah. Yep. So, you know, that's where I feel like the training.
And what's a Kong Gainer so that people know?
A Kong Gainer is a Kong vault. So two hands on a wall, and then right when your hands pass over, you tuck your knees and you backflip off the wall. So.
To Kong into backflip.
No, your feet don't touch the wall at all.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's very unnatural move.
Knees in between hands, and then you're going forward, and somehow you start going backwards.
Yes, it's a super iconic move. You don't know what it is, you definitely need to look it up after this. But I, so if we're talking about grit training, you know, I went out there, I did this move, or I had it in my mind that I was going to do it, and my first attempt was just, all right, I'm just going to throw it. I'm going to turn my brain off. I'm just going to run at this. Kong it and backflip, and I landed on my back side ish on the bouldering mat, and so and I got right back up and I did it again, and this time I think I did a handstand bail out of the Kong Gainer. So
what was the height on the other side? Is this a wall over that you shot for that video? 60,
yeah.
Can you link out that that Apex Protein video? Yeah, that showreel has this on there. And then you did the worm afterwards, if I remember. No, there's a backhand spring.
That was different. Different clip. Yeah. So I think I did Kong Gainer maybe 4 or 5 times that one, and on the 5th time I got it in the way that I wanted to. So that type of grit training, I think, is pretty cool. But if I were to go back and do it again, I wouldn't do it in that way in any capacity. I think that there's a lot of risk involved in that. And so when we talk about training versus practice versus like producing a flip or filming it, I think they parkour can use a little more bit of separation in there. Because if I were training for a Kong Gainer, I would dissect it into as many pieces as possible, and I would make sure I have each of those pieces before attempting the flip outside, and not for the final result. But I skipped all that. What I did is I tried it a few times in a gymnastics gym, and then when we went to film the video, I did all of those steps in like 5 attempts, right? So I did like my first training attempt, which was just con gator to my back and then handstand bail, and then the rest of them were like, oh, I made it, hooray. Like, I don't want to confuse that and call that training, because that's it's like, it feels just too reckless, because I wouldn't do it now, and I wouldn't I wouldn't teach anyone else to do it that way.
Well, I wouldn't, I would argue that that wouldn't really be teaching.
it's just like
it's survive, right?
There's a lot of survival.
We talk about, like, sometimes pro athletes are just ones that survived bad coaching.
Survivor bias.
And yeah, and so a lot of parkour has that. And I think it's cool in that it's existed. But I think now with the high level and high risk that a lot of these moves entail, it's a little reckless to do that outside now. You know, it was fine when you were, like, learning the double Kong, because really the catastrophe of a double Kong is not that bad. You know, like, in the early days of parkour, that's, those were the cool things, right? And Kong Gainer was actually pretty disgusting, and still is.
Yeah.
So the fact that Justin, like, had both his lab and his, like, presentation all in the same time, he's like, yeah, watch me do this thing that I haven't done before, and I'm gonna learn it as we go, is super cool. But it is, it's really risky.
I remember, I truly still believe the depth of a coach's wise is in it, the library of progressions and in their mind and in their toolkits. And it's, and I think that hacks are real. I believe in hacks, and I think it's sophisticated coaching. If you, I truly believe that there are things that athletes could come to us and work with on individually that they've been working on at any level. And I just believe in my ability to coach so much that I think I could improve anyone. I don't care what level of athlete they are, because I know some hacks, and I know I can look at things and break down the body, because I've been, I'm not dealing with alien spiders. I'm dealing with people.
It's not anatomy you're unused
to. I'm very familiar with the body and how it works. And so I think that that is coaching. And then being the subject of that is really finding those hacks is true training and improving. And that's something that I geek out on. And I want to separate that from, like, here's the anomaly that I see that I think we still need some grit for. And that's that, like, if I train or I work with someone, and it's no judgment, because there's clients and everybody's where they're at in the sense of, like, what's appropriate. But there is some value in being able to just do the work, for lack of a better term, shut up and work, right?
And at some level. Like, what type of specific
work? Okay, all right, okay, so let me explain. So,
because that's what I think I missed on my training aspect too, is like, what exactly is my specific
work? So when I was in China, right? I mean, when I trained in China, the process, they understood the selection process, and they were grinding against it. The coaches, their method was, we'll take 40,000 people, and then we'll give them the hardest stuff, and we'll get the best out of it, because everyone else will quit by the time we're done. It was almost more of a military style of selection in that way. And so it would be up at 4 a.m. It would be you run 2 miles to your coach because the buses don't run. It would be you train and sit in horse stance for warm up for 2 minutes. And then if the coach was feeling squirrely, or like people weren't taking things seriously, or they didn't have that sort of like inside of them, they weren't hard, like, then inside you'd be like, okay, horse stance for a half an hour or something like that, right? I mean, things that were just nearly impossible feats, you were going to crumble, and you were going to fight through it the entire time. And if you finished it with some degree of like face left, then you'd be back the next day. And it was meant to almost convince you to stop training what you were doing. And if you still came back, then you were dedicated, at least, despite your chronic injuries, which is why youth is so important in things like martial arts and training in that way. I think that I would not really encourage anyone to train. And so that was the martial arts stuff. You kick stuff, you train, the coach pushes you in splits, you will get the splits, you know, you will have them, that's gonna happen. You will get hit, you will learn to be indifferent to it, you will learn the way to fight with it, and you will train for X amount of time on one movement until everything down to, like, my coach used to yell at me if there was a pinky that was separate from the ring finger.
That does seem like a liability.
You could lose that. But I remember drilling forms for like 2 hours, and you'd be learning this compulsory form, the one that they were using for the Olympics. And it's a, if done fast, it's a minute and 20 seconds of jumping, splits, punching, kicking, you know, anaerobic activity. Oh, we didn't scream in that style. The South, they scream in the Southern style non-chan. But I did Chong Chan, so I avoided the screaming.
So it's very stern.
Yeah, very stern, right? You had to have what they call yish, which is like that, like, look, like something's about to, like, eat you look in your eye. And that's the first thing, like, you train that. Like, you get started in this position, and they're like, okay, you start, and then they're like, you go, and you have to have that, like the cat.
Blue steel.
It's like blue steel sword. And so you had to have that, and everything had to be perfect. And this was a problem. This is going to come back to parkour. I'm going to tell you why. Because my coach would be like, oh, the pinky was loose. So I would train for an hour or so on a form and just be like smoked, just like could barely produce power. And like I finished the form, and finally I stuck the landings on the jumps and the techniques, and my timing was right. And she'd be like, John, which meant palm, right at the end of my form. And that meant I had to do the whole thing again because the pinky set was separate in like a position. So I'd already hit everything I needed to. The form was memorized. The technique was pretty clean for where at my level. And because at the end, when there was some position at the end or something, like this was here when it should have been there, she would be, jong, that's the problem. Start over.
And you would just again. Be like.
No,
can't
one
betray
time,
me if you're not there.
Right. One time she was so frustrated with one of my classmates who had that same problem, but I think that they just like, you know, some like my hands are really like because really they're smooth. Like water would run down the back of them, right? And the that's good. That's pretty good. No, you get the thumb. She'd be mad about that. You can't let that thumb. Yeah, excuse my language. The thumb's gotta come in. That can't stick out.
She's coming out. Your teacher's coming out.
Yeah, exactly. And she used to carry a spear with her, and she could whip it like just like that. And so she would come by and you'd hear that, and you'd be like, oh no, get that freaking right. And that's how we learned. And the one student that was in class with us, he had a problem with his fingers, and I think that they kind of hyperextend. You know, some people have that like quippy little like extra like pinky like knuckle that sticks back, and the teacher was so frustrated with it, she took sports tape. And when he went up for a while, she would wrap his hand into the she would bind his fingers into the correct position. So when he did his form, he had to do it with sports tape over his fingers so that he would actually like freaking not, you know, break that pinky situation. And so that was the level of detail that was expected, and it was expected that you would do those things like get up and run for 2 miles before the buses start, train, then come back, then train again. Then have lunch, and then you get homework, and your homework was go and kick like 500 times, right? Or you know, whatever, do more training. And that made everything else that I did in life feel very easy.
Yep.
Because even when I was sitting through whatever, it would be, and there were no water breaks. Like there was no, like we have like Outrun Bistro now, and the kid goes to class and he gets 3 water breaks from the bistro who runs in the front. Every time I give water in the front, I love the kids. I think they're so cute. And I had a kid yesterday to get a glass of water. He's like, oh, it feels so good. I'm like, yeah, I know. I remember one time I trained and was so dehydrated that I just slammed like 2 liters of like water and then just threw it right back up. And coach was like, well, that was your drink.
Oh, God.
Hope you got some of it.
Hope you got some hydration out of that.
We don't waste here.
Back to work. Right. And I think that's, and I did that full consent. I paid to do that. Right. So that's when we talk about like loving training. Like in that moment, I was just so happy to be out of the Midwest and into what I dreamed of. I was always doing. They could have done virtually anything to me, and I would have taken it with a smile at that point. Not now. Anyway. So that idea of what serious training was really like, I held for a very long time. And I remember telling it to a friend of mine, Eric Rubin. I went to return to the source with in 2013, you know, shortly after we'd started the business, and went to train in the woods, which was awesome too, with Rafe Kelly's program. Mm-hmm. And I remember showing up at the airport, and I remember, I think Eric was showed up there with me. We rented a car together, and he's like, oh man, I just can't wait to get like this serious training, and this is gonna be really good. And I was like, serious training? This is a vacation. We're going to the woods with a tent. What? Are you serious? Right? And I'm like, parkour athletes don't train seriously. Like, I remember having that stigma. And I was like, this is not, no. And this hurt me because when I came back from China, after having doing the recovering from cancer and doing that thing, and I was kind of looking for something to do, I remember seeing, and it was on forums because we didn't have YouTube back then. I remember seeing David Bell, a video on him, and the early documentaries of parkour, like snippets of them, and being like, that's pretty cool, but those guys aren't serious. Because I've been through that, and I'm just watching someone essentially in their like backyard flip off stuff. And even though the stunts were impressive, I looked at that way. I looked at traditional martial arts in the U.S. that way, which was a poor judgment. And I even looked to some degree at like breakdance and stuff, where movement just wasn't super clean in particular.
Yeah.
And I held everything to that standard, but it kept me in a box. Because the only way I knew to be successful against that sport was to emulate the ancestors before you, right? There was the guy, he looks a particular way when he does it, and you're trying to look like that guy. Yeah. And the further you are from him, the more you suck. But in the West, it's flipped.
Yeah.
There's like this person, individuality is valued over optimal, the optimal representation of perfect. Mm-hmm. Right? So we're like, no, he already did that, so you're better off doing something completely different that's original.
Parkour is absolutely like that.
As someone does it, there are a few things, like some of the like manpower gap, stuff like that, right? That everyone's just working towards potentially. But usually if someone does something, you'll get, and even in B-boy, it's like that too. They call that biting, right? Yep. Where you try and take someone else's move and steal it exactly. In China, it's the opposite, which is why copyright laws are, they're like, what? Microsoft did it right. Why wouldn't we want to do it the same way? Right? So that sort of thing was my mindset. I know I'm taking a bunch of time here, but I'm just going to wrap that up. So that stopped me from getting into parkour earlier. It stopped me from getting into B-boy and hip-hop earlier because I placed that judgment and that value of optimal outcome and just trying to mirror who was perfect and closer to their perfection, which is bad even for, I think, people in just values and dogma and things like that as well, looking at one person being, I have to be that person. I have to be Jay-Z, you know. I have to be, you know, Barack Obama. I have to be someone who's perfect at the sport. And that's when I'm good, when I'm at their level. Instead of finding out who you are, and now I go at it the other direction. But it's still really hard for me because it's like, we'll do classes and someone will be like, oh, can we get water? Or like inside when we do 5 or 15 minutes of classes, and like, okay, you guys, water break. And I'm like, 15 minutes.
We just started.
Water break. I guess inside me, I'm just like, I never got like a water break within an hour. Like, doesn't even make sense to me. Like, I'm like, you have to be able to train.
I think part of that, though, is also like most Americans are also like, not as hydrated as
they
should be.
Drank water at all that whole day.
Yeah, so they like they had like their cup of coffee and then maybe a soda at lunch, and so they come in and 15 minutes is a lot when you don't have any water already in the system.
You're not used to training that. That's a good point.
And then this is not a jab at the people of Dalian, China.
Yeah,
but I'm certain that they probably didn't have soda available to them in their fridge every single day. They're probably like, I'm just gonna drink water or tea.
Ironic.
Because that's culturally what...
I was not impressed with hydration in China in general. They would say things like, oh, we're very hydrated. I'm like, but you're just sipping on tea all day and there's some caffeine in there. This isn't really good. And I remember I went to some temples and got to the top and like you would do the hike. You'd hit this huge vertical change. And then you get to the top and you'd think there's no one else up here. And you turn to the left and there's like a guy selling Coke on a Coke stand. So like... It's a thing, but they aren't as addicted to sugar as we are. I just think we're kind
of
soft.
Well, a lot of their diet too isn't as processed as ours.
Right. So there's that, but also I've been mountain biking here in Fort Collins at altitude, and I've had friends who have come and trained with me rode with me back when I would ride mountain bikes, and I remember riding for 2 or 3 hours and then just being like, I think we're gonna die. I remember one of my friends asking for like. And we're on our way back down from, Coyote Ridge over here, the run between Loveland and it's about 20 miles or something like that on bike, a few hours. I have like a water bottle. I brought like a little water bottle or something like that. And we're coming back and my friends are just dying. They stop travelers on the trail and they're like, can I have some water? my friend here is dumb. He didn't even bring any water. And I'm just like, I don't need your water. I'm just like,
I pulled it from the
3 hours. The moisture in this altitude, there's none is enough for me. Right? And which is funny because now when we train together, I just enjoy it so much recreationally. Like you'll make fun of me for eating so much. And I just loved it. I just doubled down. And I'm like, well, if everyone else gets to be soft, well, I'm soft in my own way. And we're having 5 meals in our training sessions.
Yes.
So that's just how I feel. But I already did that. Like I already paid those dues. And I know when I train and I watch people, like one of the advantages I have is that if I get in that mode of I've got to do this and this is what matters, like I can get it done. And part of that's being like raised on a farm in Iowa and training in China. And then for the 3 years I did CrossFit, we don't even talk about that. That's just learning to suffer. Mm-hmm. And that sort of stuff makes you can go to a hard place. If you've never been to that hard place to train.
Yeah. That's for sure.
You have to visit and know what it's
you
like.
You do have to visit, and that's why I throw flack at 90% of parkour training is because it's hard, but it's not hard in that way, right? Like it's not hard in the way that's actually challenging you just because you're learning something new or trying something scary. It just doesn't mimic the same as hours of grinding on the same thing in a way that's sustainable, right?
Do you think some parkour athletes, I always have this feeling, like if I asked a parkour athlete, most parkour athletes who I trained with, and we're talking about people who chose to do this, who've been training for a while, if I was like, hey, would you be willing to, this amazes me. Okay, so here's a serious question. Can you still get the results and not train that way? Because I even look at our athletes and I look at people who will train all day doing the application, mm-hmm. like doing the jumps. This is like not strength training. This is not high volumes of repetition. This is trying a challenge. They can burn the midnight oil on some of their challenges. But then if I'm like, would you be willing to, let's say, do splits for a while? You know, if I programmed in splits for you, would you train splits a couple times a week and do it loaded progressive and do the middle split? Would you do that? And they'd be like, no, but their legs are never straight. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I've come away from straight stuff because I'm trying to get into style where I want to bend a little bit and mm-hmm. look a little more human and sort of natural in that way. But in the past, like I'm pinky straight, split straight, like you just did it. And I don't know, I'm always afraid when I ask parkour athletes to do stuff like that because I think that they won't.
They won't.
Some of them will. I think we're certainly, you know, certainly as an athlete myself, you know, I've observed the change in myself into these sorts of things. And I know that, you know, that there are definitely athletes out there that recognize there needs to be dedicated sessions that aren't parkour related, right?
Yeah.
We know, and I think like Ryan Ford's done a really good job of from the start being like strength training for athletes matters. And it should be something that you are specifically working on outside of skill work, right? Which was very rare. Normally parkour used and can still be all just skill work. And your strength and your power training is all just organically built into that, right? But at some point you hit that plateau of peak performance with just that style of training, and you need to segment it and be like, I'm going to do strength specific training, or, you know, range of motion mobility training specifically, or power training specifically. And you have to be able to split those up. And I think parkour athletes are now starting to recognize that and observe that as the sports community and the athletic community starts to recognize parkour as a legitimate thing. Mm-hmm. Right. We still don't see that in skateboarding, where like you don't see people like training one leg split squats to get better at like doing ollies. Mm-hmm. We don't see them doing like ankle range of motion dorsiflexion tests to get better at doing kick flips or just bailing. I don't know why that is. I've always said that they should do that, mm-hmm. but I'm not a skater, so mm-hmm. I don't. You know what I mean? But parkour athletes are now, as they're being recognized by people external to the sport, like, whoa, what you do is cool, and that takes a lot of athletic talent. What do you do for your strength training? That question coming up is like, oh, I guess I don't do strength training, and I should. So I do see it shifting, and now with like World Chase Tag becoming a thing, athletes are gonna have to train sprints specifically. Mm-hmm. They're gonna have to train. They're gonna have to break out their sport or their focuses. They're gonna have to break it out into smaller pieces and dial it in. and spend sessions that are specifically on that thing, or not just sessions, but cycles on that specific thing, right? Like, that's another thing too that traditional sports taught, is that sometimes we spend 4 to 6 weeks on a specific thing. You're doing 5 sessions a week on sprints. Mm-hmm. And you're not sprinting max effort every day, but the goal is sprint focus, sprint focus, sprint focus, sprint focus, or strength focus, strength focus, strength focus. And that's a weakness that I think we as a sport still need to figure out. Mm-hmm.
I don't think we're asking kids to do this, though.
No, actually, I really don't like doing private training with kids.
Yeah, I think it's athletes, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about, oh, man, I don't want to ask kids to do this, but still.
I think it's a very important
train things like single leg and split leg stuff and sprints if we had a facility that we could have a really dedicated area, but I don't think it makes a lot of sense to do that on the obstacles that are meant for performance, right? Mm-hmm. So if we had like a strip of ground that was like, all right, this is our stripping ground. This is our sprinting ground.
Yes, tell us more of the stripping ground.
If we had a lane of artificial turf that was made for sprinting, we would certainly do that. I think with every demographic, age demographic.
Yeah, and I think that people also get. I have had people come and be like, "Hey, come, let's do some of this training," and they traced it a little bit, and it has to be on their own by their own free will. I just think that.
Yeah.
I mean, we live in a world where we're trying to solve so many problems for kids with movement that there can't be that level. But I wanted people to know it exists. It really frustrates me when parents come in. They kind of look at what we're doing and they kind of like, I see some parents like kind of turn their nose up at it and be like, but they're not really working out there. And I'm just like, you don't need to have that. Like that, it's there. Yeah. It's a choice. I don't want people to come in and then we just beat them with like training. And then it's like, see, we did it. We hurt them like you wanted us to, right? It's like, I don't want it to be like that. I think it's harder to be like, to go through that and then be like, I'm making the choice to like, to bust my ass.
Yeah.
That means more to me. People are like, why don't we make them work harder? Why don't we put them through more of this? And why don't we put them through more of that? I'm just like, no, like the real ones will rise to the top who want to train that way. And everybody else can find themselves in another way. It's don't turn people off to what we do by making them do that
stuff. I think it matters too that enjoyment of the sport matters more than success at the sport.
Or just success.
In athletic or you know, movement in general, enjoyment of your human body matters more than how good you are at doing it.
Matters more to me.
And that is where we start with every single person that walks into the facility, is we want you first and foremost to enjoy what you are doing.
Yeah.
And then if you're like, I enjoy what I do and I want to get better at it, because I think I'll enjoy it more when I'm better. Mm-hmm. Those people, like you say, will always reach out and they'll say, hey, coach, what can I work on at home? Hey, I'm interested in private coaching. Hey, I want an additional class in the week, right? Or something like that, because they know that, or at least for them particularly, the better they are at that sport, the more they're going
to
enjoy
it. And they will come to you. And it's just this, don't have this monolithic approach to training, right? I think is what we're saying.
And don't beat them when they're like, hey, I want to get serious. You'd be like, awesome, time to suffer. that's also not there. We still want to make sure they
Dude, like it. My warm-ups, we were going to talk about warm-ups in today. I remember one coach I had, my warm-up was 5 minutes horse stance with random punches. Like you would stand, you'd sit in a horse stance and the coach would come by and just punch you in the stomach.
You were just his therapist. He was just like, yes.
I think Travis these guys,
in,
like...
Travis Lee's coming in and I get to get my stress out.
That sounds like my warm-ups with Olaf and Taylor, though.
Yeah, that by nature, right? Like, just as we do pancake stretch, I might kick you in the face.
Yeah.
Yes, Olaf has his spirit, has this. But I also think is funny is, like, and I would say to our coaches who are listening or whatnot, there's this urge to then, you see this, and... you discover it, and then you want to get students. You want to get students doing it. So you're like, your training is not your students' training. I think that it's important to coaches separate that. And then it's always really cute when coaches come to me and they're like, "Yeah," or not coaches, but just like athletes or people. And they're like, "Yeah, you know, I think I'm gonna start working on this, and it's really hard. Or I want to do strength training, or I want to do this harder thing, or put us through something more challenging." And I'm just like, when you were younger, you probably wouldn't have done this. And now you're coming up and acting like this is what you want to do. I think that's great. But then the cute thing is that they'll kind of like judge other people who won't work as hard after that. Sometimes I feel like, or athletes will. They'll be like, oh yeah, that guy's not working as hard as me. I'm like, okay, dude, you know, when you started, you wouldn't have done that anyway. What do you mean? Back squats. You were like, back what? Mm-mm. I'll be in the back seat on the way to Taco
Bell.
Was
like, that was Jesse and I too, early on when we were training in Boulder. We didn't, like, weights were just off limits. There's no way. There's like, weights can't teach me what my body already knows.
Like, right.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, you do weights if you just want to get big and, like, look good, but not perform well. Right? And now, those are the things that, like I say, when I look back, instead of doing 12 hours of just jumping around at a park, I could have condensed that on a day that I was tired into an hour with some, you know, proper rep schemes on a back squat. I would have gotten all the same gains and more with less time and less like having to suffer, you know? And so there are those things that are still like anathema for like parkour athletes that they're just like, that's not a thing we do. And I'm like, yo, you can't be dogmatic about anything in the athletic realm except for Bosu balls.
Except for Bosu balls.
Right? So
the blue devil.
But training, the blue devil. Well, I like that one. So yeah, I think that like dialing in and focusing on something specific is training. And training hard can be a wide gradient between I do one day a week focused on, you know, particular skill or particular area of my body and 12 hours of suffering under Chinese tutelage.
I think to summarize so people aren't like, let's go, because people get excited. They're like, let's go train like this, you know, for a while or something. I think that you have to want to train that way. And I think it is something you do go through. I'm on record as saying that I think that doing like 1 hour, one day QM, you know, crawling sessions, you know, through Paris or even through here, or a lot of people have trained that way before in parkour. I think that's a very good example of grit. Yeah, because you did it, you survived it. And also doing it together, there's some camaraderie of that. Like we both suffered through this thing mutually. And I know you that way and you know me that way. There's value. But that, I don't know if programmatically I would make that something that I just baked into everyday class. And I also wouldn't make it something that is the standard for what you do before a competition where you're trying to get better in a particular way. That's not what I would suggest.
So there's, I think what you're saying is those kinds of things can be beneficial because of the mental fortitude that you gain at the end.
Absolutely,
of it, right?
Mental fortitude.
And my counter to that, a little bit of a disagreement, is that like one time in middle school, me and my friend decided that we would just walk home instead of taking the bus, right? And I grew up in a farm town, you know, Johnson.
Yeah.
And we went to school in Millican.
That's like far.
8 miles away, right? And we were like, we're going to walk because, you know, we had little legs. We didn't know how long 8 miles was. That's a long walk in the way the bird, like, by, you know,
As
the crow flies, we cut through, like, farmers' fields and everything. And, like, we were like, oh, it's going to be this grand adventure. 2 miles in, and we're like, oh, God. And we're, like, looking at the dirt, and, like, there's corn all over. And we're like, where are we, right? But when we got there, and we chugged our 2 liters of water, right, like, because we poorly planned that, we were like, wow, never doing that again. But at least I know in middle school I can walk 8.5 miles through the middle of a farm field with dirt and, you know, just navigate by the sun kind of thing.
And not get eaten by a combine.
And not die, right? And so I think there are more fun ways that you can get that mental fortitude that don't involve, like, doing some sort of fitnessy thing, right? Like, if you're going to go and do and try and improve your athletic prowess, but you want to do it for the mental fortitude, like, you could go do an ice dip in the winter, right? Like, try and swim under the ice. Those sorts of things, if you're looking to get that mental fortitude, there are more fun and more efficient ways to do it, just like there are more fun and efficient ways to train if you want to get better at jumps than going outside and hitting 1,000 broad jumps.
Yeah. I would say those are contextual because – so I agree with you. And I would say those are – and there are many things that I've done – that I wouldn't do again, but I also wouldn't take back, right? There are those sort of things. And that they're contextual, because when I got into parkour, what was really cool were things like, you know, like night missions or going and traveling and training for days and days. Like those, but they did something different for me. They built my confidence in a way that was different than, you know, doing the longer sort of like monotonous pain work, right? Mm-hmm. Like there was it's like there's probably several channels of capacity to be unlocked there as far as mental fortitude goes. Mm-hmm. And they just compound on each other if you survive them. But
yeah, that being said, I wouldn't say they're useless and a thing that you should never do.
You just don't have to be limited to parkour to do those things.
I guess what I want to say is that, like, you don't have to find somebody who will make you do horse stance for 30 minutes before you start training to get that same sort of, like, I've suffered and I know I can suffer, so I don't need to suffer now. Like mental strength, right? There are more novel ways to do it that can also benefit your practice at the,
yeah,
I think,
life, in other ways.
Or life. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you just need some, at some point though, you need to build that fortitude. I love that word. Because life will throw stuff at you, and the rest of the world sometimes looks at us as like soft, right? And us as Western Americans.
Okay.
Yeah. As soft. And you know, yeah. So it's like we have to, you know, you want to make sure that like immigrant culture is this way. Like immigrant culture, like they have that mindset of I'm gonna succeed, I'm gonna do something independently, and I escaped whatever I put in work to leave wherever I was at for a better life. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to win, and I'm going to do it and own it and own who I am and make a successful life for myself. Like that attitude and that ability to just sort of like become successful and adaptive in any environment is a skill set. Absolutely. You have to work at it. And whether poverty, sickness, privilege, or whatever pushes you into a place where you feel like you need to do it, working at that within reason, I think, is important, because then you know that's really being better prepared for the future, as long as you're not traumatized by it too much, right? So what I see a lot more is athletes who are used to being really successful in one particular facet of their training, and then they get thrown into another facet and they give up right away. They talk about this a lot with people who climb like Everest, where they're always surprised because they'll get people who are in perfect shape, or people who go through like SEAL training, they'll see a person, they'll be like, that person is a perfect physical specimen, you know, and has won everything they've done. And then they crumble in adversity because they're used to winning, and they're not used to suffering. So the sloppy looking dude makes it up the mountain who smokes somehow, and the dude gets sick, like, who is the athlete, who is a triathlete, and can't make it up, right?
He's like, this is always how it's been. It's always been difficult, so I just...
Yeah, it's always sucked. I'm always in pain. It always hurts, so I can do this.
Yeah. He's like, that kind of feeds right into like...
Fragility. It's anti-fragility.
I feel like there's this assumption in parkour, when you train really, really hard, it has to be equally as impressive to someone watching you do that, right? Like, they're like, when you're training, you imagine yourself, you know, Goku, and then if someone were watching you training, they'd be like, their minds would be blown watching you just doing your warm up. But I feel like it's the opposite. I feel like if you're watching someone doing training for moves, it should be very boring, and because they're not doing the move, right? They're sitting in horse stance for 30 minutes. No one's gonna watch that and be like, man, that
guy's or the repetition, or like drilling the footwork for strides on the ground at a shorter distance, and people are like, what is this? Some sort of like, is this person lost in hopscotch or something like that? Right.
That training it doesn't have to look so mind blowingly impressive. I think on the normal it should be pretty boring, and really it should be you struggling on the inside rather than, you know, whatever.
The intensity should be there. I also think that just on the other side of that, and I mean, I could talk about this topic forever, but we won't because we're running low on time, is this idea that I'm just going to go out and rely exclusively on that gritty training and never apply those skills. Or, I mean, there's fouls on both ends of the spectrum here.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So all I'm saying is that I hope people can derive is what is Jesse's word, what fortitude, right? Is to get the mental fortitude, to know that you have it, and stop asking me for a drink 15 minutes into class.
Or just like, sometimes I wish like athletes would just in a class or a workshop and they're like, get a drink. I'm talking.
Without
just
asking.
Go grab your water bottle, drink, and come back. Yeah, and talking to the group, you don't have to be like, can we have a drink break? Like, if you're thirsty, just go. You're a grown man. Just go get a drink and come back. Yeah. No need to like break for you guys.
Yeah, good. That's different. It's different. It's different.
Anyways, so. training hard. I think what we're all saying is training hard can look very different person to person. But everybody needs to have some sort of session where you're training that you're like, wow, that sucked a lot.
Yeah, right? I made it through that.
And I made it through that. And those never happen in the moment. You're never on your 98th pull-up in this workout being like, oh, yeah, I'm going to look back at this and it's going to be so awesome. You're like, two more. All right, and you're making weird animal noises and guttural, and then you die. Mm-hmm. And you go home. You wake up the next morning, and you get all this fun feelings from being like, "Wow, that thing I survived yesterday was amazing."
Yeah, you feel. I think that happens with injuries. I think sometimes people get a little too proud of like their broken tibia, and they're like, "Oh, so look what I did! Full part of life, full send."
Yeah, no, like injuries. Now with like injuries, I'm like.
Yeah, you guys always hid your injuries. I could never figure that out. And then now I'm like, okay, now I understand. Like,
I hurt that. Don't want to show that. Mostly because I think we also work with kids, and I don't want to glorify injury, right?
No.
I want to glorify muscle soreness, but not injury.
No.
Muscle soreness, people only know because you walk funny or you groan.
But I'm just saying, like, that's fine. I don't know, as an adult, I'm harder on my adults for that once they get in a ways is because I think that's what you need. You got to be a good role model. And the kids, don't put them through that yet. But when they look at you, they need to look at you like, that's a role model. I know that person is grinding. That person I can look up to that person. They're strong and
maybe we
can do horse stand. I don't know.
Which a great topic for maybe next time as we wrap up here is what does training look like differently for children, kids and youth?
Yeah.
Versus teenagers versus adults who we kind of lump into
right.
as adults, right? By adults, I mean like late 20s and on.
Yeah.
Right?
And parkour adulthood comes very early.
It does, yeah, if you didn't train smart.
Yeah. I mean, just saying like you're just, yeah. Yeah.
So we can talk about those differences and how they should be structured because we all know that you shouldn't make children suffer.
No, don't make the children suffer.
They don't need to suffer.
Life will make them suffer. You don't need to do it.
Hopefully it doesn't. Yeah, probably.
You don't need to do it.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. As always, we are on YouTube as well. So if you're listening to us and you want to see our pretty faces.
And Justin's injury.
Yeah, we'll link that. Also, all the links will be on the YouTube description. So if there's anything we talked about that you wanted to, yeah, wherever they put them now.
Mm-hmm. No, it's down. Because you picked the show more.
It's everywhere.
It's not even Colin
will
video.
Do cool no. stuff with the video. But can, wherever I'm pointing, one of them will be correct.
Just bouncing around the screen.
Yeah.
I clicked it.
So all the links of the things that we talked about, World Chase Tag, Justin's Bales and Successes, and
Home Gainer
stuff, will all be in the YouTube description. So check us out there. If you're watching us and you don't want to watch us, you can listen to us
on Spotify
or Apple Podcasts or wherever else. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We will catch you next time.
Peace. That's a peace. I have my thumb out. My thumb was out.